Good day, everyone, and welcome to the discretion call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question by pressing star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Mary Giovanoli. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mary Giovanoli, the Director of the Immigration Policy Center, and I'm pleased to welcome you to really an extraordinary discussion about the state of immigration law today. Ironically, as immigration has become an ever more visible and controversial part of the American debate, our conversation about it has often turned to the minute and specific details of legislation and litigation, overlooking the more fundamental principles of justice that are at risk in our dysfunctional immigration system. Today, the Immigration Policy Center releases two papers by eminent legal scholars that address some of those deeper questions, discretion and proportionality, as they apply to immigration law. Prosecutorial Discretion in Context, How Discretion is Exercised Throughout Our Immigration System by Hiroshi Motomura, and Proportionality in Immigration Law, Does the Punishment Fit the Crime in Immigration Court by Michael Wishney, are now available on our website at immigrationpolicy.org. While the papers probe different areas of the law, they're nonetheless linked by their ability to demonstrate the disparity between the practice of immigration law and our broader system of justice. In fact, these papers mark a new effort by the American Immigration Council, which highlights how the evolution of immigration law as an ever more punitive and inflexible system has led essentially to two parallel systems of justice that must be reunited. We know from the extraordinary response we received to today's call that many of you share this desire to explore these issues. So, let me introduce our moderator, Lucas Gutentag, who is the Yale Law School Robina Foundation Distinguished Senior Fellow, Lecturer in Residence, as well as a Stanford Law School Lecturer in Law, a much-beloved member of the Immigration Bar, and I'm very pleased to say a member of the Board of the American Immigration Council. Lucas?
Hi, thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be on here. I'm just going to say a few words very briefly because, for me, it's really a pleasure to introduce two such wonderful papers from two such great scholars who are longtime friends and colleagues, Hiroshi and Michael. And I think these papers today are particularly significant because the history of immigration law is one of enormous breadth and great flexibility. Traditionally, there's been discretion and proportionality in terms of initiating proceedings, bringing deportation actions, granting legal status, waiving grounds of removal, and so on. But as we all know, that was radically and significantly altered in 1996 with the 1996 law, with elimination of a lot of discretion, mandatory deportation, mandatory detention, and so on. But even in the face of that, even the Supreme Court has resisted some of the harshest applications of the recent laws, significantly through rejecting retroactivity of some provisions that we saw in the St. Cyr case in 2001, and then very significantly in the Judulong and in the Vartelis cases just now. And the courts also limited the reach of the aggravated felony provision in some very important contexts, starting with Leocal in 2004. The courts placed limits on detention and Zad Vitus, and then, of course, the landmark Padilla decision that it issued just recently, which recognized the restrictions on forms of discretion, such as the old judicial recommendation against deportation. So, but each of those, and in other contexts, the court's reaction was as to specific provisions and specific applications. And the questions raised by these papers and why I think they're so significant is that they'll go beyond the specific to grapple with the larger question of how to preserve, enhance discretion and proportionality to pursue the historic goals that those doctrines reflect in the face of these very rigid and punitive laws that we've seen enacted in recent years and over the last almost 2 decades now. So we're going to start by hearing from Hiroshi Motomura to talk about prosecutorial discretion more broadly. And Hiroshi is the Susan Westerberg Prager Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law, and we all know him as the author of one of the leading immigration casebooks, Immigration and Citizenship, along with many, many significant articles, as well as a number of recent books. So we're going to hear from Hiroshi first, and let me, though, then also now introduce Michael Wishney, who will speak next regarding more broadly the concept of proportionality, a doctrine that's been longstanding in both the civil and the criminal law context, and that Mike's paper addresses as to how we can use those principles and bring them to bear in the immigration context. Michael is the William O. Douglas Clinical Professor of Law at Yale Law School, where he also directs the Jerome Frank Legal Services organization. Mike has been practicing in the area for many years, has been teaching, and has been running the clinic at Yale, and is also known to all of us. So with that, let me turn it over to Hiroshi, who's going to speak, I think, for about 10 minutes, and then to Mike for about 10 minutes, and then we're going to turn to questions.
Hey, thanks a lot, Lucas and Mary, and for organizing the call, and thanks to everyone out there on the call. You know, as Lucas said, the question really is to try to, or the challenge is to try to put discretion into context. And so let me try to go quickly through the points that I try to make in this report. And I'll start with the fact that prosecutorial discretion is very much in the news generally, and certainly in practice circles. And I don't want to take away from the importance of the work that's being done on prosecutorial discretion. I think it's absolutely, totally important because that is what's making a difference in many, many cases. But the point of this this report that I did is to point out that there's really much more to discretion than what's called prosecutorial discretion. And there are, in fact, many points when discretion is exercised in the system. And I think that when you look at discretion, or looking at discretion as the key to understanding how immigration laws actually work, seeing whether discretion is exercised and also who exercises it. So let me try to address four questions here in the time I have. First thing I want to do is to say a little bit about different ways to think about discretion in the immigration system, trying to look at this more broadly than what's often called prosecutorial discretion. The second thing I want to do is to think about when in the process discretion is exercised, not just prosecutorial discretion, but other kinds of discretion. The third thing I'd like to do is to focus on the question of what discretion matters. In other words, where is the discretion being exercised that makes a difference in how cases come out, whether people are removed from the United States. And the fourth question I want to address briefly is who's exercising the discretion that matters. And to give you a bit of a bottom line here, I'm very concerned that it's really not prosecutorial discretion that's making the biggest difference, but rather arrest discretion, and that arrest discretion is being exercised much more by state and local law enforcement through secure communities, through 287G, and through any state laws that end up passing constitutional muster. So those are the four questions, and let me go through each of them in a couple of minutes. The first is to just to think about the different kinds of discretion that are exercised in the immigration system. There's an array of actors here. That's one way to think about it. You have federal government actors ranging from DHS officers to ICE trial attorneys, immigration judges. And you also have a lot of state and local government actors, especially state and local law enforcement personnel. And then in addition to the array of actors, I think it's useful to think about two kinds of discretion. The kind of discretion that we usually think about, for example, in the Morton memos is what I would call micro-discretion. In other words, the discretion to proceed or not to proceed against identified individuals. But there's also what I would call macro-discretion, systemic choices. There could be a choice to emphasize national security or border enforcement or removals based on convictions and that kind of thing. And the third way I'd suggest thinking about discretion broadly is to think about time. When in the point of timeline is the discretion exercised? So let me get to the second topic, is when in the process is discretion exercised? And I think they're, and drawing on some work that's been done in other areas of law, there are really five stages of discretion. Prosecution is one of them. But the first one starts with legislation. We don't often think about it that way, but Congress passes federal laws, and the resulting system it reflects a lot of discretion about who's going to be in the country legally or illegally. Most of this is macro discretion. And one of the things we've seen, of course, is that state and local governments have tried to get in on this and try to enact their own legislation. But I want to emphasize that this is where it starts. And these are all discretionary decisions about where to draw the lines. The second phase of discretion is arrests and stops. Government officers decide when to arrest and otherwise expose people to penalties, removal and otherwise. This is traditionally done by federal immigration agents, could be Border Patrol or ICE. One way to think about it is that you've got over 11 million people in the country who are undocumented. You have a number of people who are lawfully admitted but maybe deportable. And it's a lot of discretion that decides which of the 11 million will end up being arrested and put into the system. Some of this is macro discretion, setting priorities for enforcement, and some of it is micro, to target specific individuals or work sites, for example. And it's clear that local and state discretion has grown in importance in the last few years. Some of it's because of express delegation of enforcement discretion under 287G, and some of it is through programs like secure communities that identify non-citizens, and that's expose them to immigration enforcement. So that's arrests and stops. That's the second one. The third one is what we often call prosecutorial discretion. The discretion that takes place in prosecution. The decision to prosecute or drop a matter or something in between. It could be not issuing the NTA, or it could be to agree to in an application for cancellation. Those are just pretty obvious examples of prosecutorial discretion. Then the fourth stage is adjudication. Immigration judge decides the case. Could be relief from removal. A DHS could decide to agree to part of a grant of relief. DHS could decide not to appeal a case. And the fifth stage is to think about the outcome. And I distinguish this from adjudication because sometimes the adjudicated result isn't really what happens. Whether someone is ordered removed actually leaves the country, whether they're put in detention after a removal order, things like that. So I come down thinking about discretion, and again, the whole point of this is to try to put what's called prosecutorial discretion in context. There are really two questions that emerge from this, and these are the questions that I think are pivotal when we think about policy directions and the future of legislation and administrative action and advocacy as well. The two key questions are, what stages of the five that I've just identified, which ones matter? Where is discretion exercised that really makes a difference in terms of what happens out there on the ground? What discretion really translate the law on the books into law in action? And the second question that's important is, who exercises the discretion that makes a difference? So to go those questions in turn, the first one is, what stages of discretion really matter? Well, this is really a question of, who's going to be arrested, and then once you're arrested, what are the chances that you're going to be put in the removal proceedings, and once you're put in proceedings, what are the chances you're actually be ordered to leave the country, and once you're ordered to leave the country, how likely is it that you'll actually be forced to go? Now, it turns out the data on this are pretty hard to find. And I think it's quite imperfect, but let me just give you kind of a ballpark sense of this, is that we've got over 11 million people in the country who are undocumented. We have lawfully present non-citizens who may be deportable. The Border Patrol and ICE arrest about 600,000 people a year, but this includes border arrests, and so it actually overstates the chances of being arrested inside the United States. The bottom line on the data is that the chances of actually being arrested are statistically quite low in any given year, but the chances once you're arrested, or once you are put into contact with the immigration system, including through secure communities, your chances of actually being prosecuted and adjudicated and basically have the enforcement apparatus thrown at you is very high. Subject to all the fine-tuning that one could do with the data, it's clear that arrest discretion or arrest and stop discretion is the discretion that is really deciding how immigration is being enforced in this immigration law is being enforced in this country. And then the second question then And the last of the major points I want to make here is who is exercising this discretion that matters. Historically, the federal government has exercised almost all the discretion at every stage, starting with legislation to arrest, prosecution, adjudication, and outcome. But what's happening right now is the state and local governments are playing a growing role. Not only are states and local governments enacting laws that directly address immigration, but more significantly, as to the numbers at least, secure communities allow state and local law enforcement to exercise discretion, deciding whether and when to make the arrests that bring non-citizens into contact with federal enforcement. And that is what is happening with regard to discretion these days. The discretion that matters is arrest discretion, and that is being exercised much more by states, again, either through direct laws like SB 1070 or through delegation of authority like through 287G agreements or through identification programs like secure communities. So I'll close with this. That discretion is much broader than what we often think of as prosecutorial discretion, not to take away from the importance of working on prosecutorial discretion issues, but it's just one part of it. Discretion at other stages is numerically more significant, especially arrest discretion. That being brought into the contact with immigration enforcement is much more discretionary than what happens after someone is in the system. And the last point I'll make is that it's, I think it's essential to, in order to ensure, it is essential to ensure fairness, not just in prosecutorial discretion, but it's really important for the public to have confidence in the immigration system to make sure that there is effective control, especially against issues like racial profiling, when state and local governments get involved in making arrests. And if you don't have that kind of oversight and control, we're going to have a serious crisis of confidence in the fairness of the overall system of immigration law enforcement. And unfortunately, that's a lot of where we are today is a crisis of that type of confidence. So let me just stop there. I think it's about 10 minutes, 10 and a half.
Great. Thank you so much. Mike?
Thank you, Lucas, and thank you, Mary and Michelle, and everyone who has made these papers and this call possible. I'm also going to try to talk for no more than 10 and a half minutes per Hiroshi. What I want to do is introduce briefly the notion of proportionality as that exists in many areas of law, talk a little bit about how it has been developed outside of immigration law, and then suggest some ways that it might be useful both to policy advocacy work and to individual litigation in the immigration realm. I guess like Hiroshi, I'm going to kind of jump to the bottom line first, which is to say that in my view, proportionality may be a helpful organizing concept and principle for policy work, not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level for some of the reasons Hiroshi just described. In addition, I think that a proportionality claim exists as a matter of both constitutional law and the INA that could be raised in all or nearly all individual removal cases, and that might have specific utility in litigation. So first of all, what do I mean by proportionality? Proportionality is the ancient and almost uncontestable principle, I think, dating to biblical times at least, that the severity of a sanction should not be excessive in relation to the gravity of the offense. In the criminal context, it's the notion that the punishment should fit the crime. And I think this is intuitive, widely agreed upon as a notion of justice. And it's a principle that finds expression across civil and criminal law in the United States and in foreign legal traditions as well. In the United States, the notion of proportionality as a constitutional command is most developed in the criminal sentencing context, where it's a function of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. But the proportionality principle has also been found by the Supreme Court to be located in the Due Process Clause, which of course is applicable to civil proceedings, including immigration proceedings. It's most developed in the civil context in the punitive damages line of cases where the Supreme Court and lower courts have reviewed punitive damage awards made by juries for conformity to constitutional proportionality requirements under the Fifth Amendment. It arises as well under the Takings Clause and the rule that land use exactions must be proportional to the public interest at stake. It's also been held to arise under the Excessive Fines Clause, which is also the Eighth Amendment, but is often a civil fine matter, and holds that fines may not be excessive in relation to the underlying misconduct. So it's a concept that cuts across civil and criminal divides and is manifest under a number of different aspects of our constitutional structure. So let me say a bit more about how proportionality functions outside of immigration law before I turn to how it might function, and I believe should function, within immigration law. So in the criminal context, where criminal sentences are subject to proportionality review, the Supreme Court has developed two approaches. One is essentially a case-by-case analysis in which an individual duly convicted and sentenced by a judge or jury may nevertheless argue that the sentence, while otherwise lawfully imposed, violates the constitutional proportionality requirements because it's just too excessive. And here the court says that a reviewing court will begin by asking sort of a shock to the conscience type question: does it strike the court as excessive, grossly so? And if so, then the court will proceed to a series of comparative analyses looking at similar cases resulting in disparate punishments or similar punishments arising from disparate offenses both within the jurisdiction and outside the jurisdiction. So it's not a purely subjective test. There's a series of comparative metrics that get applied. And this is an approach that goes back at least 100 years to the Weems case at the turn of the last century and has been used by the Supreme Court and other courts to invalidate individual sentences. The second broad approach is more of a categorical approach in which, rather than on a case-by-case basis, the court has focused on characteristics of the offender, such as youth or lack of mental capacity, or characteristics of the offense. For instance, the Supreme Court holding that non-homicide offenses may not be punished with the death penalty. So it's a cross-the-board bright-line rule that to punish certain offenders or to punish certain offenses in certain ways would be constitutionally excessive. Those two basic approaches, both of which exist, case-by-case and categorical, also are reflected in the civil side. In the punitive damages cases, for instance, the court has applied a similar case-by-case analysis in the BMW against Gore decision in 1996. And then move towards a more categorical rule in the more recent State Farm case. Similarly has taken that approach in the Takings Clause cases and the Excessive Fines Clause cases. So what, if anything, might this mean for immigration law? I want to sketch out a few possibilities. First of all, I think that the argument exists and is correct that the same due process requirements applicable in punitive damages cases and takings clause other civil cases apply in immigration cases as well, such that the Fifth Amendment prohibits a removal order that would be excessive in relation to the gravity of the underlying offense, even if that order is otherwise lawfully imposed, as the procedures are duly followed. I'm going to say more about that in a moment, but I want to note that the Padilla case, which I'm sure all are familiar with, also suggests that the Eighth Amendment may prohibit removal orders where they are imposed as essentially the inevitable result of a criminal conviction. As people know, when Justice Stevens wrote for the court in Padilla that deportation is an integral part, indeed sometimes the most important part, of the penalty that may be imposed on non-citizens who plead guilty to certain crimes. So I think that the Eighth Amendment prohibition on penalties for criminal offenses that are excessive in relation to the underlying conduct would also require courts to review on direct criminal appeal whether the criminal sentence plus the removal order that inevitably follows, for instance, from a conviction for an aggravated felony, together are excessive in violation of the Eighth Amendment. That would be on the direct criminal appeal. But let me talk more about the Fifth Amendment requirement that would apply in removal cases, regardless of whether the basis for removal was a criminal conviction or was simply an allegation that someone had entered without inspection or overstayed a visa. There, I think the question is whether removal is a punishment of any kind. And we know that in other areas of the law, in cases under the ex post facto clause and double jeopardy and so forth, the court has consistently said removal is civil, not criminal, and those clauses don't apply. But that's not the decisive analysis in proportionality terms, including under the Fifth Amendment. There's no question that removal is civil. The question is whether, as the Supreme Court said in Halper, a government sanction is can be said solely to serve a remedial purpose, whereas if the sanction serves both remedial and other purposes, such as retribution or deterrence, then that penalty is not purely remedial and proportionality concerns are triggered. I think that imposition of a removal order is itself a punishment or penalty for proportionality purposes, even where someone lacks initial lawful status, that is, not only deprivation of lawful permanent resident status, but also a removal order imposed upon someone who's undocumented to begin with. That is, for proportionality purposes, a sanction that is not wholly remedial and is therefore subject to proportionality review. In addition, and in some ways even more clearly, with all removal orders, by operation of law, comes a bar on reentry, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or permanent, depending on the circumstances. And because the reentry bars that are necessarily imposed with the removal order plainly serve more than merely remedial purposes, but also serve as retribution or deterrence, as confirmed by the legislative history of those bars, their judicial characterization in all the case law construing them, and their human operation, that the presence of the reentry bars is plainly a penalty, not wholly remedial, that brings the removal order within the proportionality review. So finally, apart from constitutional requirements, or connected to those, in my view, the INA itself requires a proportionality analysis because the INA must incorporate these constitutional concerns. So, for instance, in INA 240C1A, not a provision I'd previously litigated myself, which reads simply, at the conclusion of the proceeding, the immigration judge shall decide whether an alien is removable from the United States. That provision, on my read, must incorporate constitutional concerns, can't be read to allow an IJ to decide an alien's removal where the removal would be constitutionally excessive. And for that reason, IJs and the BIA, as well as courts of appeals reviewing removal cases, must undertake a proportionality analysis where sought by the respondent. So what this means to me is that in the litigation side of things, I believe respondents in immigration cases could raise proportionality defenses to entry of a removal order under INA 240C1A, arguing either on case-by-case grounds that their individual circumstances are such that an order of removal together with the reentry bar would be excessive in relation to whatever underlying misconduct is alleged by ICE, as well as categorical claims that all persons of a certain characteristic, perhaps dreamers or those brought to this country at an early age, those with low mental functioning, the kinds of classes of individuals who on the criminal side have been recognized to state categorical proportionality claims could object, and that a removal order should not be entered against those individuals. In addition to providing a defense in removal, the mere raising of such a claim, in my view, would make relevant the story of the respondent's life. Many people on this call, like myself, have probably had the experience of representing someone who has an entire life story to tell that, as Lucas said, before 1996 would have been relevant to their eligibility for a waiver or some other form of relief, but now are not eligible facially for relief, and therefore their employment history, their family ties, their community work, and so forth, are not relevant to the proceeding and are not shared, are not mentioned in the courtroom, cannot be mentioned. But because all of those would be relevant to a proportionality analysis, the mere raising of the claim makes relevant stories and narratives that currently are not told, and does, of course, provide an opportunity for judicial review because these are statutory and constitutional claims, notwithstanding bars on review, such as the bar on review of discretionary applications. Finally, and I think I'm at just about 10 minutes, I think that the proportionality construct may be useful in policy advocacy at all levels. It is an intuitive account of how people should treat each other and governments should adopt policies. And it may give a language and a history and a context to arguments that some of our policies now are simply too punishing and too harsh in relation to whatever underlying misconduct we're trying to address. So I will stop at that.
Great. Thank you very much. And I know we're going to be taking questions, and there's a process for queuing up. I was going to pose an initial question while that queuing up process starts to Hiroshi and to Mike. Do we need to do something, Mary?
Yeah. Operator, could you just let everybody know how to get in line for questions while Lucas is starting us off?
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. You may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, star and one to ask a question. We'll pause a moment to allow questions to enter the queue.
Great, thank you. And thank you again to both Mike and Hiroshi. So let me just ask, maybe start with Hiroshi and then Mike with you. Hiroshi, if arrest is the most important point of discretion at the moment, at least, and so much of it's been delegated to the states through ESCOM, as you mentioned, leaving aside for a moment the kind of state laws, SB 1070 and others, but then if is there, in your view, a contradiction or a tension between the formal prosecutorial discretion reflected in the Morton memo and so on, and then delegating so much to the states through ESCOM, or through, and is there a way that you think that that could be better reconciled than it is presently? And second, and just, well, let me put the other question out to Mike as well, and then I'll get off the queue here. So, and then Mike, I was going to ask you whether you have a view on how to start nurturing and developing this incredibly important claim of proportionality in particular context. You mentioned some of the categorical examples, Dreamers and others. In terms of individual cases or claims, do you have a view as to particular kinds of cases or claims or context in which you think the proportionality claim might begin to be raised to start the process of developing that legal norm?
Lucas, you mean in the sense of arrest by state and local in the ESCOM context?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that one thing I should clarify is that when I say arrests, I don't mean necessarily immigration arrests. I'm referring to the kinds of arrests that that bring people into the process through secure communities, and so it could be a traffic stop or anything like that. If I didn't make that clear earlier, I should make it clear.
No, you did.
Now, the other thing, you asked simply more about the tension or about the relationship between state and local arrests, or any arrest for that matter, and prosecutorial discretion. I think there is a tension, maybe not a contradiction, but there's certainly a tension, and here's what it is. The Morton memos have gotten a lot of attention with regard to the fact that if someone is arrested, put into the system, that the prosecutorial discretion mechanisms and factors will be are available to mitigate any individual harshness. When you look at least the way the figures that I'm focusing on, when you look at the fact that the discretion that matters is discretion to put people into the system, then what that shows you is that the federal prosecutorial discretion embodied in the Morton memos is fundamentally just reactive. And it's really not exercising the control over the system who gets put into the system. So that's the tension. That I think it this shows that the federal prosecutorial discretion, the Morton Memo, is actually of limited practical importance, even though it's important in the cases when it's exercised. But looking at the whole system, if we have a huge number of state and local arrests exposing people in the system, then it's really going to be the state and local governments that decide. And anything the Morton Memos can do to mitigate those effects is going to be essentially reactive and not matter as much as who gets exposed to the system in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
I don't have a master plan to suggest. I think that a number of different kinds of factual circumstances would give rise to proportionality claims. But from the perspective of kind of nurturing and developing, I certainly think that lawful permanent residents probably have an easier claim here to make than those without status, because they are something is certainly being taken away from them. And so, you know, a lawful permanent resident with a minor criminal conviction, maybe an aggravated felony for something that is punished very lightly by the criminal justice system, so that the lifetime bar in return and the severing of all ties is wildly disproportionate to the actual criminal sentence or fine imposed. I think that that kind of case states a good claim for proportionality defense. I think that even as to those who lack status, those who have eligibility for relief and it's denied, cancellation application or something like that. And then finally, I think those who on the whole face serious consequences, such as a long reentry bar or serious consequences upon return, and who have developed substantial ties here, some of the classic factors with family ties, employment ties, faith, community ties, and so on, will state the strongest claims for proportionality. I mentioned dreamers and the mentally ill, and one other category I would put is the notion of registry has been in the statutes for 100 years or so, some sense of a time limitation. And so I think people who've been here for particularly long periods of residence can point to the disproportionality and the notion that that's already incorporated in the statutes, even for those who don't fit within the terms of the registry statute.
Great. Thank you both. Mary?
Thanks so much, and I really do want to thank all of our speakers and just note that this is so important for thinking through how we keep going forward on immigration reform. So let's see what kind of questions we have, operator.
Just as a reminder, it is star and one to ask a question. Our first question comes from the side of Michael Olivas from the University of Houston. Go ahead, your line is open.
Thank you. It's actually Olivas. Thank you both very much, and thank you for putting all this together. In Williamsburg last week, I read a paper on prosecutorial discretion where I was particularly critical of all the issues around the Morton memos, which have produced so very little, particularly for Dream Act kids, who you would have thought would have been at the front of the line, even on a case-by-case basis. The fact that, Mike, you mentioned them as an exemplar, you know, coincides with most of our reading of this. And I had read your work, Hiroshi, particularly your UCLA work recently, but the Dream Act kids are different. They actually out themselves, as you know, many of them do so, in part because they think it's efficacious, and so they jump all the way to your point, your number three. Some of them get caught, you know, sometimes it's through traffic stops, other kinds of, you know, small things, but sometimes they actually cross state lines and actually out themselves as part of this civil rights tradition. So my question is, why is the administration taking all of the heat for the prosecutorial discretion to the point of mutiny by some of the employees, but not giving EAD? I have not been able to find a single Dream actor who has gotten employment authorization. Now, there may be some out there because it's just hard to know them all, but I have not found a single news report. I have not had a, despite my digging, I have not found an example. And that alone would resolve some of the issues that these kids have and just buy them some time, which is the best, I think, that prosecutorial discretion can really give them now. But it leaves these kids worse off than before because they've outed themselves, which puts them and their parents at risk, and then they have nothing to show for it. Literally nothing to show because they can't work.
That makes a lot of sense. Responses from people?
Well, I'm not in a good position to report from the field directly, although I do know that what Michael's saying makes is consistent with what I have heard. In some ways, to bring it back to bring it back to the five stages of discretion I'm talking about, the situation is one where this is an example of the limitations on federal prosecutorial discretion. If EADs aren't being issued, then not only are state and local police able to act as gatekeepers, but even when the federal government wants to exercise prosecutorial discretion, that's a limitation on the discretion that they're exercising. I guess it's a self-imposed limitation, but it only underscores how difficult it is to be in a reactive position in the first place.
Thanks, Hiroshi. Anyone else? Otherwise, we'll take the next question, operator.
Our next question comes from the site of Joel Stewart with the Brazilian Consulate in Miami. Go ahead, your line is open.
Hi, everybody. I am the House Counsel here in Miami, and last year I had contact with about 3,000 illegal Brazilians, mostly from Florida, but from all over the country, actually. And many of them are not in proceedings. They don't have a notice to appear issued. And as the panel has eloquently explained, there's a disconnect because the benefits of prosecutorial discretion are only being used, if at all, for people who are actually in proceedings. And my question is, what can I do to advise illegal aliens or undocumented aliens, including these groups that you've mentioned, the Dreamers and Parents of Dreamers and many others, how can they apply for benefits? It seems that the local bar, immigration bar, doesn't have any information or advice about that. They only talk about people who have NTAs that have already been issued, and many of the people I see have applied for adjustment of status and may have been denied because they don't qualify anymore for 245I or 245K and so forth.
Well, I think you've got a very legitimate question. I think one of the problems, though, is we're not really set up to talk about the application of benefits today, and more, I think, how we sort of deal with the broader conceptual problems that we're facing. So I'm not really sure that we can answer that direct question today. Are there any other comments or thoughts that provokes from our panelists? All righty. Operator, another question? I do want to remind people that we love all the different kinds of questions people have, but the more we can kind of keep it at how do we move forward in a broader way, probably the better we're able to address those questions today.
Our next question comes from the site of Mark Nirenberg with the Law Offices of Mark Nirenberg, PC. Go ahead, your line is open.
Thanks. I was thinking about proportionality in the context of security background checks. It would have to be very, very disproportional to the individual or the state to think about putting itself at risk. But what I'm thinking about in practical terms, as many of us know, is that an Afghani who applies for citizenship will have a very extended time even getting an interview to see whether he's fit to be a citizen. And the answer typically is that it's a security background issue, and the director of immigration has said, essentially, you have, as attorneys, a toolbox, and compel us, go to court to compel us to make a decision. But speaking, as Michael was about, what's intuitive, if they're dangerous, get them off the street. and you want to find out quickly if there's something pending, then you can track them whether they're a citizen or not. But it's just the proportionality of the delay that's traceable to national security. Is that how can I put that argument together?
This is Mike. I think that question is a great example of why proportionality may give tools to shape arguments in a variety of contexts and a variety of immigration proceedings, both affirmative and defensive. This is not one in which I've given it much thought myself, so I don't have a direct answer. But it does strike me that it may be that there is an argument there that singling out Afghanis or prolonged delays in background checks does work a kind of disproportional punishment on a subset of people. And so it may give a language and it may give a claim under the Fifth Amendment. Again, I haven't looked at that context in particular, but I think it highlights the potential utility in a variety of circumstances. I was focusing on removal defense, but there may be many others where this line of cases and this concept may give a way to frame an argument that hasn't been used much before in the immigration context. In many other contexts, yes, but not in immigration.
Thanks, Mike. And I have to say, when we first started looking at your paper and working through it with you, one of the things that immediately struck me was the degree to which the proportionality argument, I think, can be a very powerful tool for talking about policy on the Hill with government officials, because you really are asking people to sort of go back to basics about what is fair, what is equitable in how we make those broader systemic decisions. And so I think it's useful to sort of take your argument and think through how it plays out in various policy realms.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have another question?
Yes, our next question comes from the side of Simon Sandoval Mosenberg with the Legal Aid Justice Center. Go ahead, your line is open.
Hi, so this is a question for Hiroshi. I'm wondering if you can sort of point us towards the bases of a right, whether constitutional or statutory, a right to the exercise of discretion. So you have examples where, for example, locally in D.C., there was a period of time for about 6 months in which the ICE field office was simply not giving bond to anyone at all and saying, if you want bond, you have to move the immigration court for it. We have discretion to give you bond, but we're not going to exercise it. Do you think there's a claim to be made in that regard?
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice, Simon. Let me just throw out a couple thoughts quickly. I mean, one of them is something that's underlying my concern with regard to the devolution of discretion to state and local levels in the first place, and that is that, I guess I did mention it, it's racial profiling. And so to the extent that discretion is being exercised on any impermissible grounds, that would certainly be one of the claims one could make. But I think you're looking for something also maybe less obvious or less clear than that. And I think that there are arguments based on the failure to exercise discretion to not really give people a chance to argue. This sort of goes back to Michael Olivas's question in a way, but to give a chance to argue that discretion should be exercised in their favor. One way to think about that in terms of specific constitutional stuff is to think about that as a due process violation. You see that in cases where the discretion should be exercised, there's no opportunity to really make the case, and that might be a different sort of constitutional hook. But I would say two things. One is discrimination. And the other is a failure to give people a chance to make their argument, which then becomes a bit of an arbitrariness type of an argument.
Thanks, Hiroshi.
And if I might just tie the two concepts together a little bit in response to that question, and maybe going back to Michael's Olivas' point about work authorization as well, it may be, and I don't know whether Mike and Hiroshi would share this view, but it may be that the proportionality principle can be used to argue that an available source or a tool of discretion that the government refuses to exercise. For example, it has the power to give work authorization but refuses to do it. It has the power to exercise discretion, the example we just heard, but it refuses to do it. Whether some proportionality principle could be used to argue that the failure to consider discretionary decisions, the exercise the power to discretion that exists in the law, is itself a violation of the proportionality principle.
That's a great, I think, tie-in. I understand that we have two more questions. If you can, operator, why don't we let each person ask their question quickly, and then we'll get final responses from our speakers. Also, just to remind everybody, the papers are available at immigrationpolicy.org. So can we take the last two questions together, please, operator?
Sure. The next question comes from the site of Mark Noferi with Brooklyn Law School. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, Mike. I had a question for you on the proportionality and really the political framing of it from an advocacy standpoint. I wanted to ask whether you'd thought of the, as far as framing, whether the framing proportionality or framing it as a question of proportionality versus framing it as a question of innocence. Just because innocence is a more bright line standard. And this is something that I think Dan Kanstrom has pointed out, that in the death penalty field, they had really started to gain some traction when they focused it from a proportionality inquiry to more of an innocence inquiry because it was more bright line. On the other hand, their starting point there was murderers who were pretty much politically indefensible. And maybe that's, you know, we have a different starting point here in the immigration field. But I was wondering your thoughts on those issues.
Mary, you wanted to take both questions?
Yeah, let's take the second question, and then you all can weave them into your wrap-ups. How about that?
All right. The next question is from the site of David Kolsch with the University of Detroit Mercy. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, Hiroshi. Hi, Mike. As you know, rehabilitation is a little used concept in immigration law, and I'm just wondering what, if any, role you see it playing in proportionality, and in particular, rehabilitation both in the context of criminality, but also rehabilitation in the context of repeat immigration violations. Thank you.
Well, thanks for those questions. First, hey, Mark. I haven't thought too much about the innocence versus proportionality framing, but I do hesitate to focus too heavily on the sort of a pure and actual innocence type claim, to use the criminal law context, because while, say, a dreamer brought as an infant carried over the border by his mother may have been innocent of the initial act, there is an argument, of course, that, you know, that dreamer is 18 or 20 or 21 and is exercising some volition personally in remaining here at some level. And it's more a reluctance to narrow the claim only to those with an actual innocence claim. The proportionality cases in the death context have not gone off at a formal level on that basis. And so the court has held that a capital punishment would be constitutionally disproportional and therefore impermissible for juvenile offenders and for those with low mental functioning, even when they are guilty. And it's the characteristic of the offender or sometimes of the crime that walls off the punishment, not the presence within the pool of some who are actually innocent and others who are not. So I have a little bit of a reluctance to go down that road, not to suggest that the innocence projects around the country in demonstrating actual errors in the system haven't played an enormously important role. They have. But I'm a little hesitant to put too much weight on that right now. On the rehabilitation concept, I think that I, of course, completely agree it hasn't gotten enough attention in the immigration context. One place it has occurred to me that it may come in usefully in the proportionality analysis is in thinking about the reentry bars. Just as the Supreme Court in Graham against Florida said that life in prison without possibility of parole for juvenile offenders violates constitutional proportionality and is impermissible. So it's not the death penalty, it's life without parole, in part because there's no opportunity whatsoever for rehabilitation. So, too, the permanent reentry bars, or even the long-term ones, the 20-year bars, as a practical matter, would seem to deny the possibility of some sort of rehabilitation. And so for that additional reason, can't be justified on those grounds.
Mary?
What, I just clicked myself on mute. I'm so sorry about that. We were joking before about who would do that, and it was me. Anyway, so thank you, Mike, for those very thoughtful answers to really complicated questions. I just wanted to see if Hiroshi or Lucas had any sort of final comments to make before we wrap this all up.
Let me just go with a couple of thoughts here. One is to think about the connection between what Mike's articulated today and what I've tried to say. One way to think about it, not the only way, but I think it's useful to think about proportionality as a way of giving some substance to the exercise of discretion. It's, proportionality, I think, is more than that. It extends beyond discretionary decision-making, but I think that it's one way to connect the two. And I'm thinking about sort of how this translates into advocacy and in the legislative sense, in the community sense, but also into litigation. One thing, going back to Michael Olivas's point, is making discretion when it exists, as in the federal Morton memos, to make it more effective, and to sort of offset the fact that it's the arrest that matters, but to make prosecutorial discretion more effective, like through the EADs. And the other thing that occurs to me is that this is a way of thinking about programs like Secure Communities and certainly 287G agreements, because what's going on is that if federal government is allowing states and local governments to exercise the discretion that's really making a difference out there, then what they're doing is not what the federal government is doing, and the state and local governments are taking on is not just exercising the discretion that matters in an abstract sense, but reducing the opportunities to make the kinds of proportionality arguments that Mike's been talking about today. So that's just a way of thinking about this altogether. It's really a plea, in a sense, to think about where power is really being exercised, mm-hmm. and who's exercising it, and the problems that generates.
That's fabulous. Thanks. Lucas? Any last words of wisdom?
No, only that I know it's time to get off, so I want to really thank Mike and Hiroshi for providing an incredibly stimulating and insightful perspectives on how all of us can be thinking about all of this work in the advocacy, litigation, and other contexts.
Absolutely. And if anyone has follow-up questions or additional comments, you can reach our authors by reaching out to Wendy Sefsaf, our Director of Communications, at 202-507-7524. We hope you enjoy the articles, and thanks very much for joining us this afternoon for what I hope is the beginning of a much broader conversation about where we go from here in reinventing immigration law. Thanks a lot. Have a great afternoon.